Welcome to the Two Vets Talk Pets podcast, hosted by veterinarians Dr. Lewis Kirkham and Dr. Robbie Anderton, who'll give you the inside scoop on the secret lives of your pets and have a light-hearted look at the latest animal news, health tips, and other random facts. All names of people and pets have been changed for confidentiality, so if a story sounds familiar, don't flatter yourself. Every owner is just as animal crazy as you are. So sit down, place your furry, feathered or scaly best friend on your lap, and it's over to Lewis and Robbie.
Welcome, listeners, to episode 207 of the Two Vets Talk Pets podcast. I am not Dr. Robbie Anderton, but I am Dr. Lewis Kirkham. We're too much talking of pets is barely enough, I believe Dr. Robbie would say. I am joined this week, though, by a very special guest co-host. She is a medical scientist and a former lab manager of clinical pathology of the University of Melbourne Vet School down at Werribee in Melbourne. I'm, in fact, today joined by my wife, Deb Kirkham. Welcome, Deb.
Thank you very much.
And for those wondering, where is the dulcet tones that is my,
usual
co-host, Dr. Robbie, he's having a little sabbatical, I believe, to watch his little team play finals, I think. I think it's his softball team that's, or wiffle ball, one of those, playing finals. I'm sure it's not a big AFL team or anything like that.
Not Collingwood by any chance.
No, not
Go Pies.
Oh, really? There we go. There's a rift in the hosts already.
Well, I've got to try and fill Robbie's shoes in some respect. So perhaps just disclosing that I'll be going for the Pies unless Carlton gets up. But yes, otherwise I'm on the Blues. But I do have a very soft spot for the Pies, so I can I'll take on that mantle for Robbie.
Dear, we might have to discuss this outside the podcast. So I think anyway. Seriously, Robbie's having a little break. He's got a lot going on with his work at the moment. A lot going on with his family life. All good though, but he's just a very busy guy. So we thought we'd try and keep the listeners a little bit happy by just ticking along with a bit of content, didn't we?
Yes. And while I can't fill the veterinary shoes of Robbie. As long-time listeners would know, I have filled in a few times, not for about 100 episodes though, but it's good to be back behind the mic. And some of the listeners may know me from vet school, but for those who don't know me, I have spent a lot of time teaching students and talking to the general public about all sorts of things clinical pathology related, so perhaps I can add some value with some technical skills or clinical skills, and all that will be revealed as we move along.
Definitely, I definitely add some value, no doubt about it, for sure. So, clinical pathology, just off topic question, I suppose. What are we talking? What would the general public sort of understand that to be?
Just general blood tests, urine tests. And these can be either routine or very specialised tests. So when people are having surgery or on their pets, they're having surgery, that might be a pre-anaesthetic.
Oh, not people.
Well, people can have the same tests done.
Sure,
it's generally the same sort of services. So we might be talking about pre-anaesthetic screening of pets or ongoing monitoring of certain conditions like diabetes or seizuring dogs, just monitoring medications or certain types of diseases. So that all comes under the umbrella of clinical pathology, which is associated with live animals. Your general pathology, you're looking at bits and bobs like biopsies or, unfortunately, animals that are deceased. So we are looking at the live aspects of health with clinical pathology. So that also can include, looking at bodily fluids or perhaps a pet has a lump and you might aspirate some cells out of that, put those on a microscope slide and in the lab we'll stain that up and a pathologist will look at that and hopefully give a lovely diagnosis.
Ah, very good. Oh, great. Excellent. Alrighty. Now, I thought we might just move on this week. At my work this week, I had brought in a little falcon came in to work, a what's called an Australian hobby falcon.
Oh.
Have you heard of those before?
I have never heard of a hobby falcon.
Oh, I did send you a few photos and it was interesting. It went to another vet clinic and they said they were scared of it. They obviously didn't have the nice thick gauntlet gloves to handle it, and so we said, oh, we take it on. We take a lot of wildlife on. Not that we're that knowledgeable at it, but we know a little bit enough perhaps to know if they're viable, I guess. You know, mm-hmm. if they're able to. And the big question with this one that came in, obviously they've got very very sharp talons and a beak that'll shred any small mammal or fingers to pieces. So we did look at it, and it did have a sore eye, which is always a concern with those sorts of birds. You know, obviously their eyesight is how they catch their prey. So, but I did look up on Wikipedia, and I'd be interested to know your thoughts. I'm pretty sure I know where Robbie would go with this sort of description straight from Wikipedia. But the Australian hobby, also known as the little falcon, is one of the six Australian members of the family Falconidae. Falconidae. Okay. This predominantly diurnal bird, so that means it's out at daytime, bird of prey, derives its name from Longipenis. And I was just wondering, Robbie'd have a few comments about that. Do you have any thoughts on where that would come from? What the term Longipenis would be in the hobby falcon, perhaps? Anything come to mind? Well, first thoughts?
Well, I suppose Robbie would instantly link the word penis and hobby.
I can think of a link there. Yes, he would certainly. Well, of course, as you know, with your Latin that you would have, that's of course because it's got long primary wing feathers.
Oh, okay.
The penis being the feather.
Okay.
And longy being long. So there we go. So
okay.
The scientific name, Falco longipenis.
Okay.
As to known to the listener. But it was interesting that came in this week because I don't know, there are peregrine falcons in the city. I'm not sure if you've seen the links to the live streaming of the love relationship going on with the peregrine falcons in Melbourne. Have you seen it?
I have. I haven't actually, had an update this year, but it gets pretty exciting at certain times of the year when those eggs are...
Yeah.
About to hatch.
Yeah, well, the live feed only goes live when I think that first egg is hatched, and we've got, I think there's three eggs now that have been hatched. But last year was very interesting. It was a bit of a threesome type scenario where I think there was one female and two males, two suitors vying for her attention. So there was a bit of fighting that was going on, and obviously one's one out, I suppose, and got the match on Tinder or whatever it is.
Oh. Yeah. So does the female stay in that nest the whole year?
Well, no. I think they only come in to lay eggs in that area, but it is the same male and female each year, unless there's a fight as there was last year.
Yeah.
And a new male has come into that. To that. So they take turns to sit on the nest and incubate the eggs. But it's really interesting that they've now got two cameras. It's on a ledge in the Mervac building. So if you want to check it out, go and have a look at there's a Facebook page called 367 Collins Falcon Watchers. So go and check that out. You can see a bit of a live feed of and it's amazing when they hatch, the chicks, the mess they make and the comments people make, and it's very, very interesting. So go and have a look at that and check it out. Bit of action in the high rises of Melbourne.
Oh, very cool. But I trust the Melbourne property market is very hot, and the rental market is very difficult to get into. So I'm not surprised that there's another male trying to edge his way into that prime real estate.
Very, very good. Yeah, exactly. And interesting, we seem to be some interesting topics. I had a client come in the other day. She was a medico doctor.
Yes.
Treats one species, unlike a vet.
Yes.
Several species, of course, and she came in and she had her cat in and recently been at the cattery and undoubtedly had a bit of sneezing and a bit of a runny eye, and we sort of got chatting. I said, you know, examined her cat, and I said, look, I think it's got a little bit of cat flu, which is a little bit of a blanket umbrella that we use to talk about, you know, a combination of viruses and bacteria that can cause flu-like symptoms in cats. And I'll sort of explain to her that some of them are viral, you know, there's herpes virus. She goes, oh, yes, I've heard of herpes virus in cats, you know. You know, there's Khaleesi virus. And then I sort of said, oh, and there's chlamydia. And she looked at me with a very, very strange face, and I thought, oh, okay. Oh, yeah. In my mind, I was thinking she's thinking that, you know, there's some sort of bacteria, chlamydia, is something she could catch from her cat. Mm. And I said, oh, don't worry, it's not. You know, you can't spread it between, you know, humans and cats. And she still looked at me funny. She said, no, but the cattery, it wasn't a free range cattery. she had her own enclosure. And then I realized she was thinking that chlamydia in cats was spread sexually.
Oh.
And so I'd actually got a little bit wrong in assuming what she was thinking. And so I was able to allay her fears that chlamydia was actually an airborne thing in cats and not sexually spread. And the cats hadn't been visiting each other at night when the lights had, you know, lights are turned down and they've obviously opened the doors and there's been some commingling.
Oh, dear. She's thinking, what service had she paid for? She thought a cat was having a private facility.
That's right. There did used to be, many years ago, a cattery in Melbourne that was the only cattery that your cat could come home with a cat fight abscess.
Oh, no.
It was literally a big room and all the cats went in there in the one room together and often you'd come home with a cat fight abscess from that room. I'm pretty sure that cattery doesn't work anymore.
Oh, but my gosh.
How's that for, yeah.
Wow. They'd need some anxiety-lowering medication after that little sojourn, wouldn't they? I know.
Fancy going back off to the vet clinic and your cat's got a cat fight abscess from being at the cattery.
Wow. Wow.
There you go. Alrighty, so big thank you to our supporters, the sponsors of the podcast. Zilkeen, the mild anxiety lowering medication. We actually had the rep in this week having a chat to us about Zilkeen and giving us some information to everybody. And so we use it a lot for animals that are traveling, particularly if they're traveling on planes and they haven't got a lot of time to trial some anxiety medication. I know I can put them on some Zilkeen. It's fairly safe, or it is safe. It's a nutraceutical, it's not a medication. And can really help with those travel sort of scenarios. Doesn't cause any sedation. So certainly something to check out. Is available from your pet shop as well as from your vet clinic. So go and big thank you to Zilkeen for your support. And also we are sponsored as well by a pet food, aren't we?
Certainly.
We're sponsored by Delicate Care. Again, Australian made. Well, not again, but they are Australian made. All Australian ingredients. Over in Perth there, they've got for the dogs, the skin and stomach, the dental, the mobility support. And also in cats, they've got a skin and stomach as well. And a dental food too. So go and check it out. It is available from your vet. And so go and check out the great food. And also a big thank you to our Patreon supporters. We do appreciate you guys. I think this is the main reason why Deb and I are trying to keep the podcast ticking along, where Robbie's having his little sojourn. for those loyal supporters out there that do appreciate us trying to provide you with some content.
And we value the Patreon supporters very much, so thank you for your continued support.
Definitely. Now, we normally have a little bit of news at this time. I don't think we've got a lot of stuff in the news. We sort of hastily got together, didn't we, to do the podcast. So I don't think we've got anything new. So I might jump on.
I've got a little bit of news.
Oh, yes.
Well, we just had long-time listener, friend of the pod, Andrew, took his beautiful Rottweiler puppy. Rottweiler puppy. Florence or Flossie,
yes.
To his daughter's football grand final this afternoon, and Flossie won best dressed pet.
Oh, really? Oh, there you go. Oh, I did see a photo. Flossie was wearing the Port Colts little guernsey.
Coat.
Yeah, little coat. It did look very cute. I did get a photo of that.
Yes.
Fantastic. Well, that's certainly something in the news.
Oh, absolutely.
And also that a grand final was won, I believe.
Yes. Yeah. I think the Port Colts won the, you know, under 15 girls dust up. So
fantastic. Good on them. All righty. Excellent. Oh, well, on that note, all advice on this show is general in nature, so please consult your veterinarian before following any advice for your pet. We do our best to provide the most up-to-date information, but as veterinary medicine is continually advancing and changing, please let us know if we have missed anything. Now, it was your idea for the topic this week, and I think it's a fantastic idea, given the beautiful spring weather that we haven't had here in Melbourne for the last few days.
Yes.
You suggested that we might talk about...
Spring.
Spring.
Spring has very sprung nice. In nice. Melbourne. We can see by the trees, all the magnolias have been out for a while, but all the blossoms are out on the trees. So it's a good time to think about the problems that our pets might be facing at this time of the year.
Fantastic. Excellent. What is there something top of your list that you thought there?
Well, I think that in Melbourne, which is where we're recording from, this is peak snake bite season.
Right.
So these first, you know, very warm days of the spring is when all those hibernating snakes come out from their places they've been sheltering, and they're cold and they've got nice full venom sacs. So out they come in the sun and they're moving pretty slowly, just ready to be pounced on by curious pets.
Yes.
And they will give a nasty bite given the opportunity. I think most of the time they will retreat pretty quickly if they can, but, you know, if they're interfered with, they will bite. So it's time to be really careful about, you know, sort of cleaning up your block of land if you've got, you know, wood piles or bricks or places that snakes like to be, and just being really vigilant about, you know, where your dogs are playing or perhaps cats, or if you're walking along creeks or rivers. These are the days that at UVet we were seeing snake bites presenting in a pretty critical state.
Yeah, okay. Well, certainly Australia, I mean, we are renowned for having some of the world's deadliest snake species. We've got the brown snakes, the tiger snakes. They're the sorts of ones I think we see around Melbourne particularly a lot. But then you've also got the black snakes, the death adders and the taipans.
Mm, sounds very scary,
doesn't it? It does sound scary. Snakes bouncing down Bourke Street, isn't it?
That's right. And did you know actually that the Commonwealth Serum Laboratory, CSL, which is here in Melbourne, they produce the only snake venom detection kit in the world.
Wow.
So behind the scenes, we can determine what type of snake has envenomated a pet using this particular test kit, but we'll talk a bit more about that in a minute.
Oh, okay. Oh, sure. Well, I was just going to say, I mean, you talk about cleaning up the backyard and stuff, and there was a study in Queensland in 2021 that found that most snake bites actually occurred in people's backyards with their pets being in the backyard. So it's not sort of what you think. You've got your pet out on a walk potentially or, you know, something like that. I guess if you're in a country block, it could be quite a big backyard that you've got. But certainly, you know, around Melbourne, it is certainly dogs in the backyard. The owner comes home and there's the dog there with a dead snake in the backyard with them, and you're not sure, did they, you know, what happened? Did the snake bite them? What sort of was the occurrence?
Yeah. And I think how do you often see animals presenting? And I think sometimes there might be, you know, just this presentation of a pet at the back door looking pretty sad and sorry.
Yeah, well, often owners are even unaware potentially. Yeah, you're right. So, unaware that their dogs or cats been bitten by a snake. I mean, you know, it's very hard to find, as you know, the bite marks. Often people think you'll see a bite mark.
No, you won't.
Their teeth are so small, they're so razor-like that even if you suspect snake bite and you go looking for it as a vet, it's often uncommon that we'll find the actual sort of fang marks or anything like that, particularly if your dog's got a bit of fur on it. I guess if they're hairless, maybe you might, but it's
certainly nothing that I ever saw, you know, with patients coming through and doing the test behind the scenes. The only time people knew where their animal had actually been bitten was if they saw it being bitten by the snake. Right. And those ones were often bitten in their mouth. Oh, wow. So as the dog went to bite the snake, they were bitten in their mouth. And I recall one case where a dog ended up with this horrendous infection in its mouth, because I cannot imagine what the normal flora of a snake fangs
are.
Oh, my gosh. It was pretty festy looking for a while. Poor thing. Okay. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So obviously the signs do vary a little bit that you see in your pet. You know, depending, obviously we're talking about Melbourne because that's the experience that we have. But, you know, some of the signs we do see of snake bites in Australia are, you know, a sudden weakness, sometimes followed by a collapse. I think, when I worked in the country, the classic one would be the dog would suddenly, would go off in the bushes, potentially, come back to the owner, suddenly collapse, then get back up again and have a vomit.
Oh.
And we'd often think, oh, that's, and I don't know if there's any truth to that, we'd often say, oh, that's indicative of quite a fatal bite, that sort of scenario. So owners be like, oh, and he's been fine ever since, you know, but we don't know what happened. And when we hear that, we'd say, oh, come straight down to the clinic. And we'd often be concerned that would be, and I don't know if there's any truth to that, but that's certainly, you know, what we would be concerned with.
Perhaps
but,
that sort of follows with what you say with a anaphylaxis in animals. Not suggesting that it's an anaphylactic reaction,
right. That's a good thought.
But you've got all those histiocytes within the GI tract, is that right? So if you get a bee sting, then you might see vomiting.
That's a good thought. I don't know, or the shock of it, I don't really know. But certainly other things we see, you know, is weakness or paralysis, usually starting in the back legs, working their way up. There may be shaking and twitching of muscles and a difficulty blinking. So they're sort of staring. Often their pupils can be quite large and black. There can be vomiting, loss of bladder and bowel control, and then sometimes blood in their urine as well, depending on the snake bite. So veterinary treatment is pretty urgent.
Yes, yes. And I guess, you know, the snake that we predominantly see in Melbourne are tiger snakes. Yes. And so the venom has a, you know, myotoxin. It's toxic to muscles. And so basically that toxin will liquefy muscles. You've got the normal enzyme that is stored in muscles, creatine kinase or CK. So when you have this muscle damage, you've got this CK leaking out into general circulation. And so if you take a blood sample, then we can measure that CK. And usually there's a decent interval between envenomation and that pet being presented to emergency or to a clinic. So you've got a little bit of time for that venom to actually start working, and having these diagnostic indicators being able to be measured. Sometimes I've seen where an owner has actually seen the snake and they've rushed their pet in so quickly that there's not actually the time to see that venom taking action.
Wow.
So you can't test yet. So I think that's fairly rare though.
Yes.
And I guess the other thing is, you know, we're looking at CK for a tiger snake envenomation. Sometimes when it seems quite clear that the pet has been envenomated, we need to differentiate, or if that owner is wanting to go down the pathway of treating their pet with anti-venom, which is a pretty expensive thing to do, then your clinician is going to want to be absolutely certain sometimes, depending on where that animal presents. If they present to a large emergency centre, they will have a snake venom detection kit on hand. And so you're not actually confirming whether or not the animal has been envenomated. You're just trying to determine the type of snake that has bitten it so that you can give the correct anti-venom. And so that the it's a special type of test that's used. So it's a rapid enzyme immunoassay, and it does differentiate between about five different types of snakes. I never saw anything but a tiger snake.
Really?
And, you know, I think other staff had seen perhaps a brown, but, you know, it's got taipan and, you know, really, you know, super exotic Australian snakes. I never saw those. I never saw those. I only saw tiger snakes. So that test is run on urine. So I think if you use that same test kit in people, you would perhaps be able to see the bite. You'd usually see where the bite mark was in a person.
I'll probably tell you, probably.
Yes.
A bit in my hand or
whatever. Yes, I guess not if they're conscious or unconscious.
Yeah, okay.
But so they recommend swabbing the site.
Ah.
But in animals, we would test the urine. So what happens is the snake venom, the pet is envenomated, that venom binds throughout the body,
mm-hmm.
particular binding sites. You know, these are myotoxins, they have specific binding sites mm-hmm. within the body. But then there will be a surplus of venom that is then excreted. And so it's from that excreted venom that we can pick that up in the urine.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, that's really interesting.
Yeah, but it does take a little bit of time for the venom to bind and for the excess to be excreted.
Yeah, right. I think certainly for you know, some vets, you know, country vets, we won't necessarily detect for which venom, which snake it is, and certainly I think there's a multi anti-venom vial, isn't there? Of sorts?
Yes, yeah. Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah, no, there is. So I think it's combination tiger and brown, which are certainly the most common ones in southern or Melbourne, Victoria, sort of our area. But I guess for the listener out there, the most important thing is if you do suspect that your dog's been or cat's been bitten by a snake, is certainly get to your vet, but it may be worthwhile ringing ahead. You know, get in the car, start getting there, but then ring ahead and ask, you know, I think my dog's cat's been bitten by a snake. Do you have anti-venom? And often, you know, certainly us in Port Melbourne, we don't have it because we don't traditionally see it in our area, and much better equipped to send you to an emergency centre where they have the ability to monitor and even, you know, ventilate if need be if we've got trouble breathing. So so certainly anti-venom, you know, administering that does increase survival rate of dogs from about 30% without it.
Right.
To 80% with the anti-venom.
Yeah.
So it's really, and it's not a cheap thing, is it?
No.
Certainly the expensive, a vial of anti-venom is very expensive. So, certainly, you know, think about that it's going to be quite an expensive cost as well.
Yes.
And a lot of hospitalisation that goes with that.
Yeah, and I think, and particularly if they end up on a ventilator and in critical care for a couple of days, you know, you're going to have a pretty high bill at the end of the day.
Yes.
So I think it comes back to, you know, preventing snake bites where you can. So, yeah, clean up your block and watch your pets carefully.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, water sources are often a source of particularly tiger snakes like to be around water too. But also interesting, often when people, their pet gets bitten by a snake, they will try and identify the snake, you know, and just don't even try.
Don't.
There's a lot of, I remember when I worked in, you know, in the country, a lot of people say, oh, it was definitely a, you know, a red-bellied black snake, or it was this sort of snake, or they would try and identify. And the difficulty is, I think I've seen photos of tiger snakes that look exactly like a brown snake and red-bellied black snakes. And, you know, we do just tend to give them multivial venom, multi anti-venom. If we can't identify the snake, and nothing worse than people coming with a snake they've chopped their head off. It's not really kind. Just let it go on its way. We've got in its path. Don't try and take a photo of it. It's likely to bite you and injure you. And then there's two people off to emergency. And also with that, you know, the old stuff of trying to put a tourniquet on the dog's leg or something like that. Don't try and do that. Do try and tempt them as quiet as you can. If possible, you know, get them in the car and bring them down. But don't try and do any fancy work of putting a cross in and sucking the venom.
Oh, my gosh.
Like the old Western movies and that sort of thing. So.
No, I think, you know, even without the Without the snake venom detection test, we can tell from other very routine cheap tests like the CK, yes, or if it's a brown snake that causes bleeding. Yes. So we can use particular coagulation tests, or often there are petechial hemorrhages, something that you can, you know, the clinical signs and the, you know, the routine blood test results will tell you which type of snake it is. So, don't try and be a snake catcher sort of Steve Irwin. No, it's just not worth it.
Oh, gosh. Okay, well, perhaps we can move on to some other things. I mean, certainly things as well we worry about in springtime is ticks.
Yes.
Not in Melbourne per se, although down Bairnsdale way, you know, Gippsland way, we do have the paralysis tick that way. And then up north Queensland, you know, northern Sydney, those sorts of areas, there are ticks as well. So important to contact your local vet and discuss what preventative they recommend for ticks, and how often and how and where you should be examining your dog. So do call your local vet clinic and say, you know, do we have ticks in the area? What do you recommend for prevention? There's a little bit on talk of using a tick collar as well as an oral tick preventative or a spot on tick preventative. Just that there is a parasite that's coming down our way, Ehrlichiosis.
He's
a little bit more prevalent. So, so you do need sometimes two types of preventive: one to kill the tick before it can bite, and then another one that if the tick does bite, it will kill the tick as well. So often there's a combination. So talk to your local vet. Obviously, I'm not in a tick area, and Robbie probably the one that would take over, knowing more about tick prevention than I would, being the medicine guy. So certainly, yeah, have a chat to your local vet. Heartworm's another one, you know, with the increase of mosquitoes in the spring months, certainly something to make sure your pet's on, know if it's in your area. And then the other thing we start to see a little bit more of, I guess, around this time is allergies.
Yes.
Is something that... certainly with the pollens that you're talking about and the beautiful flowers that are coming out this time of year, sometimes we do see a seasonal spike in allergies, particularly in dogs. So, you know, if your dogs, allergies in dogs is not seen generally in a hay fever sort of way, they don't get the runny eyes and the sneezes that we tend to get, but what they do get is skin allergies. So we see, you know, itching, a lot of itching and scratching and licking, in dogs. If you feel that your dog's doing that or they're losing hair, perhaps be aware that certainly of a time of year that we do see allergies more regularly. And again, pop down to your vet, where there are some amazing new treatments. I think maybe even last episode with Robbie, we talked about monoclonal antibody therapy, which are new injections, monthly injections, or one to three months injections, I suppose, that amazing help with scratching and itching in dogs, particularly those dogs that have allergies. So certainly go and have a chat to your vet. It's we've got something better than just cortisone like we used to have in the olden days.
That's fantastic. And I think the weather conditions are particularly I don't think it's going to be worse. I think that the grasses are flowering earlier this year because it's an El Nino year. We're shifting from the El Nina conditions to the warmer El Nino conditions. And so if you're a hay fever sufferer yourself, and I take notice of all the pollen counts, and I did hear that ABC was talking about how these weather conditions mean that it's warmer earlier, so the grasses are flowering earlier. Right. So it doesn't mean that the allergies will be worse if dogs have grass allergies, which you would see.
Yes.
And how does that usually present?
Oh, again, same thing. All usually skin irritation, yeah, that licking, you know, scratching. In the white dogs, they'll get a dark colour to their paws from licking, their saliva staining, and you can see dermatitis, so secondary bacterial or yeast infections, sometimes ear infections, but that's more likely to perhaps be food allergies. We do see a lot of scooting, I suppose, rubbing their bum, you know, certainly is something as well.
So I think it's not necessarily going to be worse, it just might be observed earlier, because I think that those things usually peak the grasses flowering peak in November, we might just see that in late September or October rather than November. So people might,
So watch out for that. Or certainly we do see people that, you know, they come in and their dog's got a bit of a dermatitis and a bit of a rash, and you sort of have a chat to them, go, oh, you know, is this the first time we've had it? And they say, oh, no, I've had it before. And then you look back on the file and, yeah, sure enough, every 12 months they've had it almost to the day.
Oh, wow.
So maybe that's going to be a bit easier with the distant El Nino cousin, El Nino, coming to visit this year. Is that right?
Mm.
Very good. Excellent. All righty. Well, did you have any other thoughts on spring sort of stuff? Some notes?
No, not on spring stuff.
No? Have you got something else you'd like to discuss?
Well, I thought that the first thing that I want people to look at in their practice and start using is their microscope.
So if we
want to look at any clinical skills or laboratory skills, we need a microscope.
Yep.
And what does your microscope look like?
Gee whiz, Deb. I shudder to think if you came and looked at it. It's adequate for us to do ear swabs where we can look at bacterial yeast from an ear. It's adequate to look at urine samples, but I think it could do with a bit of Deb TLC. Is there some things you suggest that I should be doing?
Well, I think that, you know, you use the word adequate, and I'm sure that it is adequate, but I'm thinking it's probably really dirty.
Oh, yes.
And it could use a good clean.
Oh, totally.
And
yes.
So I think for perhaps nurses who are listening, I want you to start value adding in your clinic and start using that microscope.
Right.
And over the next couple of pods, I want to talk to you about services that you can provide, but you've got to have that microscope. And so you can have a look on YouTube and you can learn how to clean a microscope, literally take you 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You can use alcohol to clean the objectives and the lenses, or you can use even some Windex. We always just use Windex.
Right.
If it's covered in oil, you might need some ethanol or some methanol, but Windex usually is great.
Yeah, well, every clinic has alcohol. So
fantastic. Yep. Fantastic.
Slabs of beer and champagne for those tough Friday nights. No, we do have alcohol and spirit,
I think the alcohol can be quite harsh on the objectives.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, while you're using them pretty roughly, your objectives have a very sensitive lens on them. And so that's why you need something lint-free to clean those objectives with, and the glass lenses and things on them. If you don't have that, that's fine. But, you know, going at them with paper towel and ethanol is probably not the best thing to do. If you've got Kim wipes Kim wipes and Windex are great. Use ethanol the first time to clean it up. But as I said, you can probably find a really fantastic instructional video on YouTube. And I think the other thing that I have found with teaching students about microscopes is people tend to be very scared of microscopes.
Mm, yes.
And a microscope, I always say a microscope is like a car. So I always had my own microscope at work. Each person generally has a microscope that they use, or if it's a shared microscope, people know their own settings for the microscope. It's like a car. If I get into your car, what's the first thing I'm going to do?
Oh, adjust the seat.
Yes, yeah. And the
knowing you, probably turn the radio down because I have it a bit louder.
And you listen to some really bad stuff. So, yeah, I'm going to change that.
You definitely change that. But perhaps you adjust the steering wheel or something like
mirrors.
That.
Mirrors.
Or the mirrors.
Yeah, the mirrors.
Yes, of course.
And so it's kind of like when you get into a car, you're going to adjust the seat and the mirrors. That's generally going to be it. I don't get into your car and go, gee, I should adjust the timing belt or the wheel alignment. But the funny thing about a microscope is that, various users will tend to not go for the basic stuff, you'll start adjusting the condenser and the light source. And, you know, people will sit down at a microscope and realize they can't see anything down it, and they will go for the worst things to change, which make it even harder to see down there. And so that's what I would always find. You go off to tea and then come back and find someone's been in here and totally trashed my microscope. And they've invariably meddled with the condenser. And so that's sort of closing down or opening the light source. And so you turn on the microscope, you can't see a thing because the lights, the condenser has been closed. Okay. And people just start twirling all sorts of things around. Don't do that.
Don't lift the hood and change the oil and fiddle with the fan belt.
Literally, right? When you use a microscope, the thing that you should be adjusting to suit you is the interpupillary distance. So that's the eyepieces will move outwards or inwards according to the distance between your eyes, which is a very personal thing. So you only want to do that and you want to focus. So you've got your coarse and fine focus. That's really all you should be doing regardless of what you're looking at. So all those microscope users out there, I want you to clean your microscope, set it up so that you can see down there, and then put a sign on it saying, do not touch anything apart from the focus.
From the focus and the eye,
the distance between the eyepieces.
Is there any link between the distance of the eyes and intelligence? Just a little off topic sort of thought there, because I often get on the microscope and I feel like I've got the widest eyes. I feel like I'm a salamander, or I've got eyes at the side of my head.
Like a chook.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And everyone else like an owl, where I'm like a chook with all the big salamander, like Tom Hawkins' salamander. Anyway,
well,
I digress.
I probably can't comment on that, but I think that that's the issue. Is if you've got multiple users, everyone's going to be adjusting things that don't need to be adjusted. And the main thing about a microscope is when you want to use it, it needs to work for you.
Yes.
So you just want to be able to sit down, adjust the distance between the eyepieces, and then go for it. So you want to be able to look at your specimen. You're going to want to start with 10 times, probably work up to 40 times, and you need a nice clean microscope that hasn't been fiddled with so that you can view your specimen really quickly.
Right. I think the big thing that we find with ours is the 40 times objective that we use, which is the one before the oil, tends to get sullied with oil on it.
Because people you should never go all the way around, either clockwise or anti-clockwise with your oil. And I wouldn't have thought, like, what sort of things are you looking at under oil?
Ears. So looking for bacteria or yeast, I suppose.
Yep.
And sometimes I'll use it for urine, looking for bacteria as well.
I think sometimes the way you can get around that is on that the piece, which I can't think of the technical. If you put the ones like the 10 times and the 40 times next to each other, you can usually unscrew that 100 times and put it right around the other side. So it's a really long way around.
And 6 o'clock.
Yeah. Perhaps try that just to really separate that out so that people aren't just, you know, switching back and forth.
I did hear somewhere that you can buy a 40 times objective that's oil.
Oh.
Now, I'm not sure if that might be a solution. So then you could, because obviously it's more about, it's definitely never me.
I wouldn't do that.
No, never do that. It'd be everyone else in the clinic who would be doing that. And the listener, none of the listeners would be dragging that 40 times through the oil at any stage at all. But maybe getting an oil one, is that an option? Do you know if that's available?
Perhaps. I don't know. I was not generally an oil user. Right. The stuff that I looked at is generally, I'm not a big microscopy person, so because I'm not a hematologist,
fair enough.
I would not tend to be looking at things under oil.
Still good to get your insight though.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So I would generally look at a film under High and Dry, but we can talk about that at some other time because that's another technical skill. High and Dry,
is that a little breadcrumb for the next one?
But I think yes, what I would like to help people with are these things that can improve what they're doing at work and just advance their own knowledge.
Yep.
And I think that's something that perhaps people can very easily do. They might be scared of these things, but they can very, very easily integrate some of these technical skills into their work. They provide very quick answers, which are great for case management, and you also can improve your the value that you add to your practice. And then you can ask for a pay rise.
Oh, I like where you're going. This is fantastic.
So
good way to look at it. I would love our nurses at work to be skilled to do, you know, upskilling to do, you know, ear swabs, and they certainly do the urines. They do prepare the urines, but I'm not sure they all look at the urine. But anyway,
We can talk about all that sort of stuff. So if the listener has a question about any technical skills that they would like to talk about, or if there's something about a test that they would like to understand or they would like to be able to perform in-house, hit us up.
Fantastic. Great idea. Hit us up. We're on, unfortunately, because Robbie's not here, we're not on all the socials now. I don't think we're on Telegram anymore or what's Donald Trump's one? I don't know. Anyway.
X. No. What's he got now? I don't know. Some strange.
Yeah, he's got his own social media. So anyway, Robbie's on all those ones. But if you do have a question about testing, you know, things you want to do in the clinic or even a general vet questions, you can find us at twovetstalkpets@gmail.com. We are on Facebook at twovetstalkpets. And also on Instagram, so we do check those ones quite regularly. But certainly any of the exotic ones, we'll have to wait till Robbie returns from his little sojourn that he's on at the moment to check those if you send any questions. Oh, we do take questions through Patreon as well, and we certainly prioritise our Patreon questions as well.
Yes, and we also, I think we were talking about we should get a specialist guest on. So if anybody's got any ideas about a topic they would like to have covered, we can hit up our network of people.
Oh, what sort of specialists they like, or if they've got a recommendation for a specialist who they'd like to hear on the podcast. Certainly, yeah.
Yeah, we've had a few really good guests in the past. You know, Simon Hearn. No, Simon Hearn, ophthalmologist. We had Laura Broccoli, who's an oncologist.
We've had Clint Yuderman has come on for a bit of a chat, baked us a cake too.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so if there's someone you think could bake us a good cake, certainly take their recommendation too.
But I think your most popular person was, or someone that listeners really tuned into, was Danny Houlihan, the dermatologist. So
yeah, Danny Houlihan and Laura Broccoli are our top two, I think, certainly. We had Richard Gown on, the cat guy as well. So certainly, if you've got anyone you think might be good, or you want to hear hear what they've got to say, certainly hit us up as well. And we can certainly chase them down and see if we can get them on the show.
Yes.
Now, normally you get a bit of a peace out from Robbie. Have you got a sign out? Have you been thinking?
I think that I usually
swipe out or a microscope out or blood smear out.
Oh, well, I haven't thought of this, but I could actually do a mic drop, couldn't I? Microscope drop. I think in the past, as I said, I'm not a great microscopy person, so I probably wouldn't identify too well with that one. I think in the past I have just said signing off.
Scratch you later.
Signing off.
Thanks for listening to Two Vets Talk Pets with Lewis and Robbie. To chat further about this week's episode or ask the guys any questions, search Two Vets Talk Pets on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or send an email to twovetstalkpets@gmail.com. You can find Lewis on Twitter with the handle @vetbehaviorist, and more importantly, as the two pet heroes return to their day job of saving animals' lives, be sure to thank them with a 5-star review on iTunes. Every time you do, a small, cute animal will receive a cuddle.